Hello there, football fans. Hope you're doing well, and thank you once again for joining us on the Soccer Central podcast. I'm James Sharman, joined by John Molinaro, fresh off a fun-packed weekend full of international intrigue, JMO. Did you enjoy the qualifiers?
I did.
You did?
They get a bad rap, but...
They do, for good reason, in some cases.
I was on my couch all weekend watching England-Slovenia, Wales-Belgium, Italy-Croatia.
You're a crazy man.
Yeah, it was
living
quite enjoyable.
Living life on the edge as always.
That's why I'm single, so...
Well, it's been a pretty packed show today. We'll discuss some qualifiers shortly, but later on we'll also discuss Canada-Panama coming up on Tuesday with Jerry Dobson of Soccer Central, of course. But right now... We're going to talk some English football. Now, Chelsea at the moment are obviously playing really well. 9 wins, 2 draws, no losses. And some people are beginning to use the word unbeaten and invincible, which is, for me, way too early. But we know that it isn't impossible. Arsenal did it back in 2003-2004. And we're joined now by Amy Lawrence, who wrote a book on that very season. Amy, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
Well, thanks for joining us. Listen, we know what's happening right now and the hyperbole in the press about Chelsea, but with the Arsenal season back in, I guess, 10 years ago now, wow, it's crazy. Do you remember when the media began suggesting that this could go, you know, all the way without being beaten?
Well, funnily enough, they started suggesting it about 2 years previously. there was a Arsenal won the league in 2002 without losing an away game, which in itself was quite a rarity. And they started the next season like an absolute train in pretty similar fashion to the way Chelsea are playing now. They were just smashing everybody. And they were reigning champions, winning every game highly convincingly, great players at their peak, unbeaten, and around sort of late autumn time, the question came up in a press conference to Arsene Wenger, can you go this season unbeaten? And he said, well, I don't see why not. Like, it's an ambition, and you'd be mad not to aspire to do it. And the following day, it appeared in the newspapers with a bit of top spin, and Arsenal promises we're going to go the season unbeaten, which wasn't quite what he was saying. And promptly, I think it was very, very soon after that, with perfect timing, a young boy by the name of Wayne Rooney, who was about 17 years old, appeared on the scene for Everton and smashed the last-minute winner, and Arsenal were beaten. So at that point, Arsene Wenger was being relentlessly teased for having made this bold prediction and immediately falling flat on their faces. But then the season when they were to finally do it, they started off pretty well, but it wasn't really something that people were talking about because it had been sort of shot down from such a height 2 years previously that people thought it was a fairly ridiculous thing to try and do. And it wasn't until quite late on in the season that really the bandwagon started to roll with quite a lot of force and speed, and this notion became something that was constantly being talked about. But I would say that was probably, you know, almost heading up for next spring. So to talk about Chelsea and their potential to going unbeaten, it does still feel quite premature, even though they have such fantastic attributes right now.
The title of the book is Invincible, Inside Arsenal's Unbeaten 2003-2004 Season. Maybe you can just tell us, how did you come to write this book? What was the opportunity that presented itself to you?
Well, through some immense good fortune and the very, very kind recommendation of an author called Nick Hornby, who you may or may not have heard of, who his publishers, Penguin, somebody thought, hey, this Invincible season, it's 10 years coming up. This looks like a good idea for a book. And Nick said, well, if you fancy that, why don't you have a chat with Amy? So very kindly, I owe him everything, and checks and posts and big drinks and long lunches or what have you. But they approached me and asked, would I be interested? To which my immediate reaction was, how on earth did I not think of this? It seems so blindingly obvious. A subject quite close to my heart. I watched that team a lot. I grew up watching Arsenal and knew some of those players from that time through work, and knew them to be a really exceptional group of human beings. You know, this wasn't just a talented bunch of footballers. This was a talented bunch of people, full stop. And if ever there were a group of footballers who you thought had the ability to tell their story well, I think this team... certainly had such intelligence and such interesting characteristics. They were quite individual, but they shared a lot of common ideas. And it all came together at the right time to create this team that were, at that moment, much more powerful than everybody else. Which, again, when you look at Chelsea now and make that comparison, the one thing you would say is, although Man United were a lot more competitive then than they are at this point, and were, you know, were winning a lot of titles at that time and were way stronger, Arsenal still seemed probably better than everybody else at that point. And I think you look at Chelsea now, and it's difficult to find competition. And that's where people are saying, I don't even think they're going to lose, never mind that anyone's going to knock them off winning the league, because apart from Southampton right now, who are on an amazing run, the major contenders that you would expect to be up there look way short.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, when you look back at that, you know, incredible season from the Gunners in 2003-2004, I mean, what made that team so special, aside from the fact going, you know, unbeaten for the campaign, but was there one or two intangible qualities when you look at them, when you look back at that side and say, wow, this was really something special?
Yeah, I mean, I think Arsene Wenger told a nice story about how a friend of his from France came over one day to visit him at the training ground and decided to just sit in the entrance and watch these guys come into train one day. Obviously, the environment around the training ground is completely different to sort of the match day vibe and the elements in the players and in a team and its characteristics that we as fans, you know, get to see and make our judgments of and study body language of players when they're under pressure of playing and they're on show and they're in the spotlight. But in training grounds, away from the public eye, that's when you see sort of the normal man, if you like, and rather than the performer. And this guy, this friend of Arsene's, was sitting there, and afterwards, and he studied them all coming in, and he said afterwards, Arsene, I watched your players come in, and each one of them coming into work, they had this aura, they had this charisma. And it, that story chimes, really, because the opportunity to go and speak to these players, which I did to research the book, even now, 10 years down the line, they still all have a very, very strong sense of aura and charisma and intelligence, a sense of desire and motivation. They love their football. They were all guys who were very, very keen to stretch themselves to the limits. You know, you can have a number of such players in a team, but it was striking how many of such players were in this team. And on top of that, they were just particularly good footballers. So you're looking at a guy like Thierry Henry. He was one of the best players of his generation, or any generation. Patrick Vieira in midfield was a phenomenal player that Arsenal have never really truly replaced. In the defence, guys like Sol Campbell, Ashley Cole, fine defenders. Arsenal would love to have defenders like that right
no
now.
No kidding.
So, you know, and I haven't even mentioned Dennis Bergkamp, who was, you know, a proper genius. And an original, Robert Pires, wonderful, wonderful footballer. So the variety of skill sets allied to this phenomenal team spirit that they shared and this competitive winning mentality that each of them brought to the table. Roberto Silva arrived a couple of years ago. He was a World Cup winner. He walked in the door and he was the most humble guy. People said they looked at him and they couldn't have imagined he just won the World Cup. He wasn't Mr. Big Shot at all. But inside, he had incredible drive. So they were a special group of people, and they all came together and decided that they knew how to get the best out of one another and push each other and challenge each other. Let's be the best. Let's be the best that we can be. And with Arsene Wenger in charge, creating this environment, I mean, Arsene Wenger is a coach. He's not at all in some ways like Mourinho. He's kind of the opposite. Mourinho, he gives the impression of being in control of every single tiny detail and drilling his players so that they know what to do blindfold. Wenger's not like that. It's much more freeform, but he likes to create an environment where his players can just express themselves and have everything behind them to go out and perform at the best level that they can. And it was all there for them that season.
You know, you mentioned those names, and it really is a reminder of just truly how great that team was and the personalities of each player as well. You know, these were not robots at all, as you mentioned there. Now, you allude to the team concept in that room, and clearly to be that good, you must have, you know, all buy into the same story, so to speak. But what was the one player that was the leader, the main man? Was it a Patrick Vieira with the armband? Was it someone else? Who was it?
Do you know, that's exactly a key point, because it really wasn't one man. If you said that somebody was the leader, I think probably a few others might fight you for it. That's how strongly they were in terms of the amount of collective leadership they had. There were so many leaders, and really the armband was incidental. I mean, from an outside point of view, people, you know, Patrick Vieira, 6'4", giant of a man, who, apart from Roy Keane, nobody would ever dream of taking him on in any kind of fight. You know, he had the armband for a kind of example reason. But in terms of what people brought to the group, I mean, I'll tell you a small story. Sol Campbell used to play behind Patrick Vieira, and Patrick knew that, you know, for all his strengths, one of his weaknesses was that he did have a tendency to switch off a bit if he thought it was a bit of an easy game, or he could just drift off and get a bit sidetracked. And he actually asked Sol Campbell, who played behind him, listen, if you see me make a mistake, if you see me drifting off, you scream at me. And so Sol Campbell used to give him a proper rollicking during games if he spotted that, you know, that Patrick was sort of, you know, not quite in his full levels of concentration. Because in some ways, a guy like Patrick Vieira used to find the game easy. Bergkamp was a very important leader, in that everybody looked up to him, and that even in his late 30s, he was a guy who was searching for perfection every single day on the training ground. Thierry Henry was a big leader as well, in a different way. He was very vocal. He would love to talk about football and analyse football. And, you know, morning, noon, day and night, he would look you in the eye and discuss details of football matches or training sessions or what had been going on, what could be changed, what worked, what didn't work, how to just get more and more out of themselves. So there was a huge variety of... Jens Lehmann, I've not mentioned him, the goalkeeper, he was slightly crackers, you know. he brought an intensity where a bunch of players who were already, you know, had a great winning spirit. According to Patrick Vieira, Jens arriving pushed that winning mentality up even higher, because if anybody wanted to have a laugh in training, Jens would go mad. So I would say there was at least half a dozen who could lay claim to sort of being vital in terms of the leadership of the group.
We're talking to Amy Lawrence here, football correspondent for the Guardian newspaper in England. Amy, the book is, I mean, there's an exhaustive amount of research that you obviously did, and there's a lot of interviews, you know, from former players and key players who were in that Arsenal side. I'm interested to know how supportive was Arsenal in this project, in terms of granting you access, you know, inside the hallowed halls of Highbury and the Emirates. How helpful were they to you in terms of the writing process, and how open were they?
They were definitely supportive and helpful, but of course most of these players were no longer at Arsenal
right at
the time I was writing the book. So in terms of setting up interviews and stuff, obviously they still had contacts with a few of the guys who had moved on and helped me to get in touch with Lauren and Gilberto and a few of the others. And they predominantly, the most importantly, helped me with Arsene Wenger. That was the big interview that had me biting most fingernails off.
I can imagine, yeah.
I had to wait really till the bitter end for that. The interview was all fixed up for midway through last season, and then when the wheels fell off last season, the pressure was on, and suddenly he was a bit too busy and didn't want the distraction, and it was getting postponed, and we were getting very close to the deadline, which was just in between the end of last season and the World Cup. And I knew if I had one chance to get it, and it was going to be in that week. And of course, Arsenal were in the cup final against Hull City. And I pretty much knew that if Arsenal won that cup, that I would have a chance. And if Hull City won, that I didn't think that Arsenal would feel like talking about it.
So at 2-0, you're saying, oh no.
So yeah, there was a lot riding on that, the 2-0 down. Obviously, it was he was fantastic. He was in a phenomenal frame of mind, obviously, the pressure off winning a trophy after 9 years. And you could see he was very reinvigorated at the time and very relaxed and really happy to look back, which he doesn't normally like doing. He's a forward-thinking guy who isn't one who sort of dines out on what he's done in the past. Mm. He's constantly trying to think about what he can do tomorrow to make things better. So that was helpful. But, I mean, other than that, I was fortunate to have some good relations with a lot of the players from before. So I think the fact that I wasn't a total stranger asking them for an interview meant that they were willing to do it. And it was lovely to hear how keen they were to talk about those times. You know, they care deeply about what they achieved then. And I think the time to be able to reflect on it and really delve into the detail was a nice experience for most of them. I got the impression they were really, really happy to talk on and on about those times. And I think also there were people outside of the immediate playing staff, other coaches that I wanted to speak to get a perspective about how the team worked behind the scenes. David Dean, who was Arsene Wenger's kind of right-hand man who ran the club, he was the vice president at the time of Arsenal, was fantastically helpful and gave me huge insight into what goes into not just the creation of a team in terms of what they do training, but actually buying players, dealing in that marketplace, how you go about putting the pieces of the jigsaw together to create the team. And it's difficult. You know, buying players is, as Arsene often says, you know, you wish you could walk into the supermarket and pick up a centre-half. It's not that easy. So to get that kind of the impression of the work that went in behind the scenes as well was my attempt to try and give a portrait, if you like, of a club and its workings from board level through management level through players level, to try and build an impression of what was going on, what everybody was contributing.
I mean, let's discuss Wenger here, because back in those days, like you mentioned, he built that team, he created it. He was known as being this great talent spotter. You know, you pick a Henri up from Juventus and just, you know, reinvent him into this wonderful centre forward. You look at the Arsenal team now, and, you know, we can discuss it for hours, the weaknesses, and it's been there for a while, the lack of steel, the issues in defence. Has Wenger changed, do you think, from 2004 to nowadays?
Well, to an extent, he's changed in that he's 10 years older, and, you know, I guess sometimes with age, you do slightly change your ideas. But I think the two most significant things are not so much that Wenger changed, but the way that football has changed around him. And the two big factors, I think, were the arrival of Roman Abramovich and subsequently other football clubs who have been taken over by hugely wealthy billionaires, whether it be Paris Saint-Germain, the money that came in for them, or Manchester City. The ability to compete has become obviously much more difficult, and that coincided with the time that Arsenal left Highbury and they were tightening their belt, really, because they knew that they had to, you know, not spend as much as they used to spend. So all that was going on, which has made life very difficult. It's radically changed the landscape. The other thing that's happened was that Wenger became very influenced by the sort of Barcelona, Spain, tiki-taka era, which, you know, I guess started to really dominate the football landscape 2007-08 onwards. So he suddenly tried a slightly different style. And as a consequence of that, if you can do that and you're the best, like Barcelona or Spain, you don't have to have big giants. But if you're not quite that good, then you can miss the steal, which has been a difficulty for Arsenal to find that balance. So I think it's been a question of style and a question of money, and those two things put together made it a really, really challenging decade, basically, for Arsenal.
Any funny stories that you heard along the way, Amy, in terms of, you know, her interesting anecdotes that you came across in your interviews? And
I'd like to think there are several.
I'm sure there are.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple that I suppose spring to mind that I particularly like. Colo Touré was a youngster from the Ivory Coast who came over for a trial. You talk about Arsene Wenger plucking gems and his talent-spotting ability. This was a kid who had never been outside of Africa playing football, and he came over for a trial. and he cost next to nothing when they decided to buy him. It was like a couple of £100,000, and it was virtually free in the modern market. And during his trial at the training session, he was so over-enthusiastic to try and show off what he could do that he just went around cluttering one player after another. I think he took out Thierry Henry, and then he smashed Dennis Bergkamp, and, you know, player by player, they were all getting a heavy tackle off for Kolo Touré. And, you know, of course, you don't want to get injuries, so it was. I think all the players were looking at each other like, who is this boy? What the hell is going on? And then the ball went out of play, and Arsene went to pick it up, and Kolo Touré steamed into Arsene Wenger and smashed him over as well. And Arsene Wenger was actually injured and had to get treatment.
Oh, geez.
So, of course, the boy thought he'd completely blown it by not being able to really control his emotions and how much he wanted to, you know, to show off what he could do. And he was really upset afterwards. And one of the players went in while Wenger was sitting there with his ice on his leg or whatever and saying, oh, you know, this boy's really upset, boss. You know, I don't think he meant to injure you. And Arsene turned around and went, no, it's okay. He said, I like his attitude. We'll sign him tomorrow.
Nice.
So I think that was great. And another one that always goes down well is Martin Keown, who was another hugely important and influential player, even though he didn't play that much at that point because he was getting on. He was 37, I think, by then, but was really a huge leader behind the scenes in encouraging and making sure the players were keyed up for all the various challenges. And he needed one more game to get a medal because he had to get 10 appearances in the Premier League to qualify for a Premier League medal. And he was on 9 going into the last game of the season. And he was already quite fretful because Arsene Wenger, who kept promising to put him on in matches, had a habit of either being forgetful or not quite noticing the time. And Martin was always worried that Wenger wouldn't put him on. And he'd said to the referee before the game, don't blow the whistle until I get on the pitch, whatever happens. And with a few minutes to go, the time's ticking down and Keown's still not on the pitch. And he's getting more and more tense. And Ray Parlour, who was a bit of a class joker, said, go and warm up, Martin. Go and start warming up in front of him. And he goes and starts warming up, and he's running up and down the touchline. And Ray Parlour said to the others, right, I'm going to do the biggest wind-up ever. And they had one substitution left with a couple of minutes to go, so Ray Parlour gets his tracksuit off and is standing there stretching as if he's about to come on in his kit. And he said he's never seen Martin Keown run so fast in his life. He pelted down the touchline to try and get there before Ray Parlour went on. And also went for Wenger, I think, had him round the neck. You know, boss, you've got to get me on. So I guess that gives you an idea of the lighter side that you need, you know, in a kind of team sport environment, as well as the sort of serious competitors.
Absolutely, yeah. The book is Invincible, Inside Arsenal's Unbeaten 2003-2004 Season. You can follow Amy at AmyLawrence71 on Twitter. Amy, thank you so much. Great chat, and congrats on the book.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Cheers, Amy.
Amy Lawrence, got to read that book. Haven't got to it yet.
Haven't got to it yet.
But obviously, being an Arsenal fan, Jamie, you appreciate such anecdotes or stories getting inside that team. Because, I mean, listen, I worked some great teams over the years, but I can't remember a more complete team, I think, than an Arsenal team.
They were just, I think, more than anything, they were just so bloody fun to watch. I mean, when you think about, you know, talking about guys like Bergkamp at the height of his powers and Thierry Henry and Robert Perez, who for me was probably my favorite player on that team because he was just such a dynamic player who could kind of make things happen. And they were just a joy to watch. I mean, it seemed like every time they got the ball and they raided forward that they were going to score and that, you know, their opponents were going to concede 10 or 12 goals. So, you know, it was just a bloody entertaining team to watch. It really was.
Well, switching gears now to some international chat, and Canada's back at it on Tuesday, up against Panama, as Benito Floro continues figuring out just what this team is. Jerry Dobson, our very own Jerry Dobson, has the call with Craig Forrest on Sportsnet on Tuesday night, I believe. Is it 7:30?
It's 7:45.
Oh, 7:45.
8 o'clock kickoff.
All right, I'm glad I've done my research.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, Jerry, long time no speak.
Yes, 7:45, we're on the air, James, so make sure you turn on the telly to have a look.
I'll be watching it and PVRing it. I can guarantee you that much. Can't miss Canada playing. Listen, Jerry, Benito Floro, he's been here for a while now. He's got through, I think, last count, 456,000 players in that time. But it does seem that with this squad looking pretty strong once again, his strategy is becoming more and more clear as to what he's trying to do with this side.
Well, he's bringing in younger players. I don't think anybody would argue with that in terms of what it looks like he's trying to do. When you see that a young player like Maxime Tissot gets his first call-up, if you got the other young Montreal player, Carl Ouimet, who's getting a few games now, you know, and the Kyle Beckers of the world and Jonathan Osorios of the world and the Daniel Stenise, these kind of players are getting these call-ins to the national team, and so he can figure out what he has to deal with when it comes to both the Gold Cup next year and World Cup qualifying. So I don't think there's any doubt that he's looking towards the future, which is coming around awfully quickly.
What do you make of the job that he's done so far, Jerry? He's been in the position a little over a year now. It's obviously a rebuilding year, and as you said, he's trying to, you know, give the youngsters as many possibilities as he can. But when you think of Floro and the job that he's done overall, what are your sort of general impressions of the man so far?
Well, you know, I think it's hard because they haven't really played anything competitive yet, and he's pulling together different players every time he has a camp just to see what he's got. But when you look at the results, I mean, usually a year after a World Cup fallout or a World Cup, you know, disaster, which is what we had, things are pretty bleak. And it was bleak until this year. And when you look at the results with just one loss this year in four games, that's not bad, and that loss coming against Colombia, a game where Canada played really well. So I think we still have to say that Benito Floro is on track, and we have to let him do what he's doing without too much criticism until next year, and then we see what happens with the Gold Cup and the initial stages of World Cup qualifying. But I think until then, I think we have to just stand back and say, go to it, and let's see what you can do.
You're right. I mean, obviously, he is blooding the kids, and he has to at this point, but there are some very familiar names, once again, in this squad, including Julian de Guzman, who is still without a club. At what point is this becoming a major concern for Floro? He has to have his top players, you know, essentially guaranteed starters, playing regularly, surely.
Well, you know what? This is simply my opinion, and I have no evidence to back this up. It's only an opinion, and I think that my opinion is that with some of these older guys, and I think Julian de Guzman is a perfect example, he's just using them to help guide the younger players along until they are ready. I can't see that there's a future with Julian de Guzman, especially if he remains in an unattached situation. You know, he's back in Germany just spending time with his kids and living the life right now. So I'm not sure how serious he is about his future. I haven't talked to him about it, but that's my opinion on this, and it's just a guess simply on why would you bring in a guy like Julian de Guzman at his age, and he doesn't have a club, unless you just want some stability with some senior players to help make it comfortable for the young guys.
And do you think that's the same reason why he's calling up guys such as Di Rosario and Bernier, who they're not out of contract with their clubs, but they are, I think, 36 and 37 respectively? When you think about it, maybe they're going to play for the Gold Cup, but it's really hard to see them involved in the next round of World Cup qualifying. Is this just about, like you said, bringing in some experienced hands to provide some mentoring for the youngsters?
Yeah, I think they do kind of fall into that same category. They may be useful next year in the Gold Cup and in the initial stages of World Cup qualifying, because let's face it, it's going to start probably in June next year as well. So it's not that far away, and so he might be thinking that I can still get a little bit out of these guys in the Gold Cup and with the World Cup qualifying, because it's going to be a busy year, and then eventually those guys will fall by the wayside, and it'll be up to the youngsters at that point. So I think that's what he's thinking about. It seems to me that's what he's up to anyway.
Now, one young player conspicuous in his absence is Tesho Akindele. Now, obviously, if you read into it, the story there is he declined a call-up. He essentially is waiting to see whether he can get into the U.S. men's team. It's a familiar story, isn't it? He says that, listen, I still might well play for Canada, but I'm keeping my options open. How many times over the years, Jerry, have you heard a young Canadian player say, I'm keeping my options open?
Oh, just about everyone. I mean, when you look at it, it's just simply a matter of the makeup of this country, isn't it, fellas? I mean, we have so many people in this country of mixed backgrounds that hold more than one passport, and that translates into the soccer world as well, and we have so many players like that. And you know what, whatever is in Tesho Ekindele's mind, I mean, I don't know. I'm of two minds of this kind of a situation, and I guess it depends on the player. I mean, I hate to see a guy who is eligible for Canada to go and play somewhere else. But I think, on the other hand, you have to look at each individual case. And I think with Ekindele, he falls into the category of a Teal Bunbury. And I don't fault Teal Bunbury, although he may be regretting his decision right now. But with Ekindele, he was born in Canada, but he grew up in the United States. He very well might feel American. And if a guy feels an allegiance to a country based on where he was brought up, you can't change your heart with something like that. You can't change your mind. It's simply a feeling that you have. And if that's the case with Ekindele, I don't think you can fault him. Now, if he's just simply being, you know, pragmatic about it and thinking, you know what, I don't have a chance of playing for the United States, so I'll go back and play for Canada, well, that might be what he's thinking as well. But he may have stars in his eyes like some players do. I'm going to go play for England, or I'm going to go play for the United States, play one game, and you'll never hear from him again. So it's a big decision, whichever way he goes.
We're talking to Jerry Dobson here on the Soccer Central podcast. Jerry, obviously Ekindele not there tomorrow, but Benito's called in several other sort of youngsters, as we've discussed before. He's really sort of intent on giving a lot of young prospects a chance to play. Is there anyone on this 23-man roster that, you know, you're looking forward to seeing more of tomorrow that you think, yeah, you know, I'd like to see what he can do in a competitive situation?
Well, I've always wanted to see Jonathan Osorio. We haven't seen enough of him, I don't think. You know, you asked me if there's any one guy. There's actually several guys. I want to see more of Osorio. I want to see Russell Tybert, who is playing regularly for Vancouver, but he's been out of the national team setup for a while. I want to see more of him. I'd like to see some of Bryce Alderson, recently let go by Vancouver. I don't think there's much of a chance of that. I want to see Maxime Tissot, and I want to see more of Carl Ouimet, because I keep hearing, and there seems to be an indication that Benito Floro is very high on Carl Ouimet. He keeps bringing him in and he keeps using him, and I'd like to see more of him as well, so we can get a better judgment on what we think these players might have to offer, although it doesn't really matter what we think, does it? It only matters what Floro thinks. But these are the kind of guys that I'd like to see more of.
And, you know, it's interesting because I think, you know, Canada, if nothing else, we used to be renowned for our goalkeeping, and, you know, obviously Craig, you know, was a big part of that. I wonder, though, if we have a firm, definitive number one, because, I mean, Lars Hirschfeld seems to be, you know, spiraling down a little bit. Kenny Stamatopoulos, a fine guy. I wonder if he's just if he's cut out to be Canada's starter. And Milan Borjan doing well in Bulgaria, but I'm not sure that he's playing all that regularly in the Bulgarian League, in the Champions League. I don't know. What do you think about sort of the goalkeeping situation? It's probably unfair to ask you, seeing how you work with Craig, but I mean, I've long held the belief that we've never really found that ace goalkeeper since Forrest retired.
No, I would agree with you on that one. It used to be obviously our strong point, but it's not a strong point anymore. And I kind of think that Floro is just biding his time with these guys, Borjan, Hirschfeld, Stamatopoulos, just trying to get through this period with these players until he decides that one of the younger guys is ready to go. And we have some good young players that we haven't seen hardly any of in the national team, the senior team, in fact, none of. I mean, Quillen Roberts comes to mind. There's some fine young goalkeepers in the youth system. And he may be waiting until those guys are ready. And in fact, I'm sure that's what he's doing. It's just a question of how long before somebody stands up and is ready, and how long before Borjan Hirschfeld and Stamatopoulos just simply can't get the job done anymore. So I think that Floro is counting on the youth in that position as well.
I could be wrong here, Jerry, but I'm getting the impression from the fan base that they may have never been as patient as they are right now. They're very willing to sit back and let this team grow from you know, blooding these young players and looking at a big picture, not short term. No one's really thinking this team can qualify for 2018. That's the impression I get. Do you remember a time where the fan base has been this patient?
Probably not, and I think maybe it's because the fan base has been expecting so much over the years, and they're just worn out.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Tired of being disappointed. And so let's give it some time and see what happens, because if you remember going into the 2010 World Cup qualifying, there were high hopes for the team. Like, a lot of people thought, this is the team that can get there. And then when it came to 2014, the hopes weren't nearly as high, and the Gold Cup prior to that, and and then the team, well, the hopes were high, I guess, but maybe not quite as high as they were 4 years prior to that. And then the team got within that one game of getting to the hex, and of course, huge disappointment again. So I think maybe everybody's just worn down by the whole thing, and it's like, you know, whatever, show me what you got when you've got it, and then I'll decide if I'm ready to believe. But I think people are being more patient. I would agree with you.
You're going to be calling the game on Sportsnet tomorrow with Craig Forrest. How do you, in your research and just sort of your general observations, how do you think Canada matches up against Panama?
Well, I think they'll be fine. I mean, it's not a World Cup qualifier, and I think that would change the equation, because when you go down to Panama and play in a World Cup qualifier, and we've seen what's happened in the past with the people keeping the guys up awake all night, and believe me, that does have an effect. Those guys didn't get a wink. They didn't get any sleep at all that night in that game, in that World Cup qualifier a couple of years ago. So it's not going to be like that. So I think that helps equalize things a little bit. Panama's been very busy. They played El Salvador a couple of days ago, won by a score of 3-1. They played Mexico last month, so they've been very busy. But I think that on any given day, I think Canada stands up well against Panama. Historically, we have done well against this team, and so I don't see any reason why Canada cannot get a result tomorrow night.
Well, coverage begins at 7:45
Eastern.
7:45 Eastern, okay, so make sure you check it out. Jerry, thanks, pal. Chat real soon.
You bet. Take care, fellas.
Cheers, Jerry.
Jerry Dobson, all right, yeah, I'm looking forward to that game, actually.
I am, too.
I thought the Colombia game was, I don't care if it's a friendly or not. It doesn't matter. The team they faced in truly a world-class Colombia side, I thought Canada did just great. And maybe it's a bit patronizing, but too bad.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's...
You held them to a tight game.
Yeah. Well, they lost.
I know they lost.
Yeah.
But it was a tight game, though.
Oh, tight game. Sorry, yeah, I thought you meant a tied game.
A tight.
Yeah. No, I thought they played, you know, all things considered, they played really well against the third-ranked team in the world, who were coming off an impressive run at the World Cup. So, yeah, I mean, and remember all the talk beforehand, too, was like, oh, well, this is going to be 5 or 6 nil.
Yeah, exactly.
And the fact
yeah.
that they made Colombia work, and they didn't score until, what is it, like the, something like the 75th or 76th minute. You know, I think that's encouraging. And, you know, you think back to when they beat Jamaica in September in the preseason friendly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are encouraging signs. I'm not saying that they're going to qualify for the World Cup, but, you know, it's a rebuilding process. So you got to take these small victories when you can.
So it was fun to see Atiba throw the entire team in his shoulders, too.
Yeah.
It's quite an act, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I mean, and you kind of joke about that, but I do think, like, without Atiba Hutchinson, this team is a lot different, right? I mean,
he wasn't there for Colombia, though, was he?
No.
Which is even more impressive.
Yeah, but they, like when he's in the lineup, then they're, you know,
yeah,
he gives them really a dynamic sort of attacking force, and I think they just look a lot more positive going forward. So, yeah, as long as he can stay healthy, then I think that's promising for Canada.
Before we go to the internationals, about 5 minutes left here, keeping the Canadian theme, I think last time we spoke, I was trying to get out of you the rumors regarding TFC's DPs and who they're targeting, right? And
right.
You refuse to budge,
right?
But since then, of course, it's been reported on a few fronts that they're looking at, just say looking at, Steven Gerrard and Wesley Sneijder.
Yes, well,
were they the guys?
Those were the two names that I heard that they had been targeting. They hadn't at the time when I heard it. They hadn't sort of made any formal approaches or anything like that to their.
Well, they can't until January.
Well, yeah, you can, but you can't. I should say. But those were certainly the two names. But, I mean, again, the source that told me about that was like, it's not going to happen. It's just even though they've targeted them and you know,
sure.
It's not going to happen.
Sure. At the same time, I mean, who would have said that Jermaine Defoe would ever sign with TFC? He's not the same quality of these two players,
yeah.
But...
I don't know. Can you see Steven? I mean, with all due respect,
Gerard's staying where he is.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, that's just an agent. I mean, a lot of stories about Gerard's future, and he said, you know, he might play somewhere else if he doesn't get a contract. Well, of course he will, because he wants to play still.
Sure.
Right? But I'm sure they'll figure it out. Get him a one-year deal. He could have left that team a long time ago, and he didn't, so why leave now? As for Sneijder, I mean, listen, he's playing Galatasaray. He's playing out of his preferred position. I believe he'll be out of contract end of this season.
I think it's actually he's got another 2 years, but the complication there is that he hasn't been, or I don't know if it's, there was a time where he hadn't been paid for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
So if that continued to go on, then that could have voided his contract. But now there's all this talk that he's being linked to Manchester United.
Yeah, and listen, was it 5 years ago?
Yeah, right.
I mean, if Sneijder wants to leave Galatasaray, I'm sure he does, he could walk into most teams.
Absolutely.
Yep. In Europe.
Yep.
However, money talks, and you know, if you throw money at a guy, maybe he'd come. He'd be the type of guy you want to get as far as an attacking midfielder who's not over the hill yet. Well, be perfect, right? But listen, that's a stretch. Let's be honest here.
Think about that midfield with Bradley and Michael Bradley.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty darn good.
That's what you need.
That's pretty darn good. We should say congratulations to Michael Bradley because his wife Amanda had a baby daughter the other day.
Congrats.
Yeah.
He's got, is it two kids now?
His son is 4 years old, Luca, and then this is his daughter. So born in Canada, so she's
eligible.
She's eligible.
Nice. Hopefully she's better hair than him.
Yeah.
Internationals very quickly. Italy, Croatia. It was going so well for Croatia.
It was.
They were playing really well. They were attacking. Italy, for some reason, was playing super defensive in their second half, sitting back, relying on the counterattack, and then some moronic imbeciles throw flares in the field.
Right.
Taking Croatia really out of their momentum. And, they delay the game for 10 minutes, come back, and it ends 1-1. But just asinine behavior once again.
It is. The idiotic Croatian fans who, I don't understand the rationale in terms of throwing flares on the field to disrupt the game when your team is, clearly putting the boots to Italy, right? So to halt the game like that, it was... I think it's just ridiculous. I think some of the, not some, but a lot of the blame here has to go to the Italian, security authorities at San Siro. The fact that, these Croatian fans were able to sneak in so many flares.
It wasn't just one.
No, I mean, look, if it's one, then you say, okay, like stuff happens, right? But when, you're talking about 20 or 30 flares, I mean, that's really outrageous and unacceptable. I mean, someone could have been hurt, whether it's in the stands or one of the players on the field. So as much as we want to sort of chastise the moronic Croatian fans, and we should. I don't think we should let off, the Italian security at the stadium off the hook either, because that was appalling scenes.
And we're seeing it more and more now.
We are.
Incidents at games. This is the second match day in a row that a game's been suspended and obviously abandoned originally with the Serbia-Albania game. That's more political, of course.
Right.
We don't know the reasons before this game. Was an agenda by a certain group of ultras? Perhaps.
Right.
There will be an investigation. UEFA will probably drop the ball on it, but I'm just getting sick and tired of seeing this crap, week in and week out, be it in the Champions League or the Europa League, empty stadiums, away. It's not working. The message isn't getting across.
I agree.
There's only one way to deal with it, and that is to dock points and possibly kick countries and clubs out of tournaments. And, that might seem overly harsh, but what else do you do? They're not getting the point across, and you can say, well, these fans don't care, they're not real fans. Well, it's up to the FAs and the federations to police their own fans as well. They're sending the tickets to these guys.
Right.
So get your own house in order first. Netherlands beat Latvia 6-0. It's Latvia, I know, but listen, Laronio were playing so poorly, much better performance.
They needed that one.
That was a vintage RVP performance too, wasn't it?
It was.
Way better assists, scored a goal. He was outstanding in that match.
Yeah, they really needed that one because, Gusevic didn't even quit. Yeah, he was quitting.
They lost,
Latvia. So, they're not out of the woods because that's still a tight group with Czech Republic and Iceland.
Czechs are perfect.
Yeah.
Again, yesterday.
Yeah.
They've come, I think, from behind twice now in this qualifying campaign to win games.
So that's, they really, if they had dropped any kind of points in that one against Latvia, they would have been in real trouble. So good on them.
Davey Blind out for a month, six weeks. Boy. United lose De Gea.
And De Gea, too.
Carrick as well. I'm not sure how bad the groin strain is, but he was out as well, left the England squad. So if you're Van Gaal, man, you are not getting any help here at all, are you?
No, but my sense is not too many people are entirely sympathetic to what's going on with Man United.
Belgium, Wales nil. Great result for Wales.
Fabulous. Yeah, it was a great game. I watched that one, and you're going to hear nil-nil, and you think, oh, it was a snooze fest, but it wasn't. I mean, it was pretty open, very electric atmosphere in Belgium for the game. Wales kind of squandered some chances, as did Belgium, both Gareth Bale and
Benteke. Bale hit two posts, right?
Yeah, and Benteke had a chance that was kind of thwarted by – he bumped into Fellaini as a cross was coming to the box, and if Fellaini had just laid off, then Benteke probably would have headed it home. But it was an entertaining contest.
I'm surprised that Origi started ahead of Lukaku as well.
Yeah,
he's playing well for Lille this year. Origi,
well.
I know Liverpool want him back sooner than later, but the loan deal is what it is, and they can't get him back before the end of the season. Although they could, I'm sure, negotiate that.
They could,
but why would Lille?
Yeah, exactly.
He's their top striker right now. He's playing really well. Yeah. How old was Aaron Ramsey, by the way? In that game?
I was okay. Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
He says he's going to get back to his top form with Arsenal soon. And
well, I hope so.
Yeah, you better hope so. England beat Scotland. Scotland. They're playing Scotland on Tuesday. England beat Slovenia 3-1. Dour affair in the first half in particular. Came to life in the second half, but England should be beating Slovenia. The pitch was a disgrace. I got hammered on Twitter by one moronic idiot, an Englishman.
Why?
Because I said, the pitch makes me ashamed to be English, right? And he just thought that was the worst thing I could possibly say. I'm a disgrace.
Treason. Treason.
People. Spain, they won as well. Again, they should beat Belarus.
Yeah.
3-0 on that one. Isco's
that goal was
coming out
finish.
Party internationally, wasn't it? What a finish, yeah. He was superb.
That was fabulous.
Germany only managed 4 against Gibraltar.
Yeah, that was I was kind of surprised by that.
Isn't it crazy when we're saying only 4?
Yeah.
But everyone thought that was going to be double digits.
I certainly did. I thought it would be at least 10.
Germany taking the foot off the gas, though, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think they squandered some chances, too. They could have easily piled it on, but for whatever reason, they didn't. So, yeah.
Scotland beat Ireland 1-0. That was a combative affair, as you'd expect.
Combative?
Not
that's
for
one word
purists,
for it.
Perhaps. Not for purists of continental football, but for purists of Brit football. It was amazing, kicking lumps out of each other.
Yeah.
Nice goal by Maloney.
It was very nice.
A really nice goal.
Yeah, it was very nice.
Portugal beat Armenia 1-0. Boy, they do it the hard way, don't they?
Yeah, never easy. Again, that's like kind of like Holland. They really needed that win.
So yeah.
Good on them.
Well, that's the end of the show, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
What's coming up this week on the website?
Well, glad that you ask. A whole bunch of stuff. I mean, you're going to have your EPL Q&A on Friday, and Paul Dolan is going to do an MLS Q&A ahead of the MLS Cup semifinals, so we'll have that. We'll have comprehensive coverage of Canada-Panama tomorrow. And that's a good segue because just a reminder that you can watch Canada versus Panama and England versus Scotland on Tuesday in international friendlies live on Sportsnet. Plus, the Premier League returns this weekend with a full slate of games airing on Sportsnet. For a full rundown of matches that we'll be showing, go to sportsnet.ca and you can check out the broadcast schedule. And James Sharman, Brendan Dunlop, and Thomas Dalby will be recording another edition of the Soccer Central podcast on Thursday, previewing the EPL weekend, which should be fun. Until then, cheers for listening.